Good afternoon. So last time we talked about some topics related to security related things, OS Stu, mostly about restricting access to things like files and other resources managed by the OS. And one sort of broad technique we talked about for doing this was this idea of access control lists that we have typically attached to each object, like a file, a list of who is allowed to access it, identified in some way. And the primary sort of mechanism we thought about for doing this is we have some way of identifying users or groups of users, and we'd associate these IDs with the running program. So a running program would have some number of user and group IDs, which would say what things was it allowed to access. And this identifier is what the operating system, the kernel, would actually know about. And most of the rest of the logic related to like how does logging in work and so on would actually be dealt with in user space. We talk about how we had this sort of super user notion. So we had our login program, which was just a normal user space program, and it just told the OS, yes, I figured it out. This program should run as this user ID, and would spawn that. We also talked about giving users access to things that are beyond their permissions for and selectively. And we had the mechanism that POSIX used for this of set user ID programs, where we'd run a program like sudo and would run as a different user, and it would decide whether we were allowed to do those more privileged things. In the case of sudo, it ran as the most privileged user, super user root, and it would decide based on some configuration file if we were allowed to do some operation when we entered a password or not. And this let us have like these more selective policies, like we could let people access the printer but make sure they don't print too many pages because we know that they could only access the printer through this one program that would enforce that policy. Also mentioned that set user ID programs were really hard to write. And one reason they're really hard to write, we talked about, was that often they want to like check something and then use it. And because their entire environment is controlled by the user running them, you know, those things can change. So we have this notion of a time to check to time of use vulnerabilities. That you check, is this file okay? Then you use the file, and if you do that in a set user ID program, well, you're in a lot of trouble because the person running to you could have changed the file in that time window. Then we talked about a very different scheme for controlling access to files. So all this access control scheme was based on some notion I called ambient authority, that you had authority just around you because you were running in a particular process, but it wasn't directly attached to how you were accessing things. You asked to read, you know, etc shadow, which had the passwords. You could ask to read that no matter who you were, and it was just based on whether you were an important process or not that you got to access it. We have this alternate model of capabilities where we give out handles to access objects, where objects can include ways of discovering other objects like directories. And if you have the handle, you can access it. If you don't, you can't. And importantly, the idea here is that there's not this sort of look-aside check that when I open a file, can I access it? We know you can open the file because you have a handle for like the directory containing the file that says you can, or you don't. And, like, that's where the checks are. And this is less error prone in some sense and easier to figure out what you can access because, you know, the process of identifying the thing you're trying to access inherently says whether or not you can access it. We give an example of something in POSIX, which acts very much like capabilities, which are file descriptors. That if you have a file open, you have a file descriptor, that's how you refer to the file, and that says you have access to it. If you don't have a file descriptor, you don't. And therefore, there's no way read's going to get confused about whether you're allowed to read from the file, because either you opened it successfully or you didn't. So questions about things we covered last time?
So on the quiz, it said that it's more difficult in the capability system to stop a user program from having access.
So yes, so the question is, in the quiz we argue that it was more difficult to stop a user program from having access. And the big problem is that the user program has a handle to an object. So like, I have an open file, and you want to stop me from having access to that file. Well, if you just change the permissions on that file, it won't do it.
I thought maybe we could invalidate the handle?
So yes, that would be the procedure. But this is more difficult because now we need a way, given the file, which we don't have a different handle to, finding all the handles to it. So it is indeed something you can do, and something real OSs do, but it's this extra step that we didn't have to take with like access control list. When I set the file as read-only, you can't open it anymore. When I set a directory, well, I guess a good, better example is when I set like a directory is not writable, you can't put files in the directory anymore. When I set a file is not writable, if you have it open for writing, you can still write to it because we aren't checking again whether you can do that. And if we wanted to enforce that, we need to have the set the direct file as not writable operation figure out who has a handle to this and are they one of the people who shouldn't be able to write to it? Because we know not all users should do that. And that's more complicated. So it's something you can do and it is something that some real operating systems have done. But this means that there's this extra bookkeeping for all the handles to the objects to figure out where did this come from and is it one of the ones I want to revoke permission of? Because we don't want everyone who's opening the thing to not be able to access it, just certain users. That makes sense? So other questions? Okay, so I'm going to have one, I'll skip over that. So one final topic in security I'll talk about, and then we'll talk about virtual machines, which is mostly not going to be a security topic. So another thing that operating systems can do for security is something known as sandboxing, that we want to run some code that we don't trust very much. Some possibly dangerous code. So one example is I get some code from the internet and I want to like see what its output is, but I don't want it to like write files over my file system. Another example is I just assume my code is buggy and is vulnerable. And we want to run it in a way where it can't do anything harmful. And this is actually a pretty common thing. So for example, video parsing code is code which is written to be fast, typically not written to have great error checking, and has had lots of sort of buffer overflow vulnerabilities where the code with a malicious video file can be made to do bad things. And one thing you could say is let's fix that code. That's a great idea. But another thing you can say is why don't we just make sure we're running it in a way where all a bad video file can do is give us bad video to look at, bad pictures, rather than like writing over my file system. Another example is when a browser runs some scripts in a web page, we want to make sure that those scripts don't do anything bad. We'd like the OS to help us enforce that, even though like hopefully the script interpreter will prevent bad things from happening. Or if I'm running your student submissions, I want to make sure they don't do anything bad accidentally or on purpose. I'd like to run them in this restricted environment. And something to note here is that the user running these programs doesn't need the program to have the full permissions. Now, there's this big disconnect between the access control list model I talked about and what we actually want the program to do, be able to do. So in the case of my video parsing code, I want the program to take in my video file and output a bunch of images and audio. There's a lot of things that if it's running as my user, it can do that I don't want it to do. Like, if I have my taxes stored in my home directory, I don't want the video parsing code to open that, but it can do that because it's running as my user ID. And we'd like the OS to provide a convenient mechanism by which we can ask the OS, hey, here's some video parsing code. All I want it to do is read this video file and output pictures and audio. Don't let it do anything else. to find a convenient way of doing that. And this is something that people can set up, and people have built this sort of system. And the most prominent case where this type of isolation is used, where you want to run part of a program without giving it permission to do everything, has been in browsers. So Google Chrome was famous for being probably the first major browser to do this. And basically what they said is, well, there's the thing which figures out what the web page looks like. That code doesn't need to open your taxes. So let's run it in this restricted environment we'll call sandbox, and let's use inter-process communication, by which we mean something like pipes, to talk to it, and make sure it can't do anything else. That it's not going to be able to read my taxes, it's just going to get the web page and put out, here's the picture to show. Okay, and we can do this with the mechanism we talked about, but it's pretty awkward. So with our access control list idea, we know each user has access to particular things. So a way we can approximate the sandbox idea is we create a new user, and we switch to that user for the privilege code. And ideally, since that's a new user, it doesn't have any files that it has special access to, so it shouldn't have access to random files on the system. That should be pretty good. This actually isn't great still. And the big issue is that even ordinary users can still do way more than we often want. For example, any user can open up a network connection. And that's probably not something we think should be happening when we're taking a web page and just making the picture of it. We don't want that to open up a network connection to a random place. So that might be a bit more than we want. And if we have the capability-based model, this is actually way easier. With capabilities, we just run a program and we just make sure, since you have to use these tokens, these capabilities to access anything, that doesn't have any tokens we don't want it to have. So you just close the capabilities it doesn't need, and in a capability-based OS, you can't ask to read at C#, you need to say, here's my directory, read a file in it. You don't have a handle for that directory, you can't do it. So in a capability-based system, this is actually pretty simple. But there's another common mechanism that we have, especially because in real OSs we have this type of problem that users can do, even unprivileged users can do too much. And also because creating new users is really annoying and not something we can do for every single application you want to run, which is basically what we want to do here. So we want every single application to run as a different user. So there's this idea of just doing what's system call filtering. Because the way our program's going to access anything interesting is with a system call. So we're just going to run a little bit of code before every system call and say, is this system call okay? And this is going to be configurable and allow us to restrict what happens. And Linux supports setting this sort of thing up with the setcomp system call. So you call setcomp, and it makes a process have this filter in front of all its system calls. And most simply, it has something known as a strict mode, where the filter is, if the system call number isn't read, write, xset, or something known as sig return, then don't allow it, just kill the program. And that means that the program can't do anything but read and write file descriptors it already has open, basically. And if we think about our video parser or rendering, that's enough. It reads and writes the pipe to talk to us to get the video file or the web page, and it writes back the images to show. It also supports, more complex modes where you can specify a little programming language, and I really mean a programming language, to specify the filtering, if you want more interesting rules. You want to allow certain types of network connections but not others, you can do that. So any questions about this idea? So this is an example of an operating system feature to support this sandboxing idea, that I don't want everything I run as myself to have permissions to do all the things that my user can do. But we don't want to just create new users ad hoc for every single little application. Okay. Questions? Okay. And usually the use case for this is not that we expect the code to try to do that, but that we want to, you know, protect from bugs in the code. That you want to make sure that even if the code is buggy, we're still okay. Like, the worst that can happen is we get weird results. And this is especially in the browser case what we want to happen. The idea is that if the web page can trick the browser into doing weird things, the weird things are only going to affect how the web page looks and acts, not how the browser like writes things in my home directory or like copies my taxes to a remote server. That's not going to be possible. And so sort of what our use case would look like, you know, here's our video decoder, is that we'd have our video decoder, like it reads the video file from standard in, writes the images to standard out, and it just calls this enter sandbox function at the beginning, which sets up that system call filter. And now the idea is that if this dangerous operation does something bad, it's not a problem. And we don't need to really care about what that, you know, what files that might access, because we've just prohibited it from doing any of that. Okay. So that's all I have on security. So our next topic is going to be virtual machines. And you've all used virtual machines. And we mentioned briefly at the beginning of the course that we had this idea of process virtual machines, which our OS provides something that's kind of like a machine, but with these convenient interfaces like files, device files, and system calls, rather than the actual underlying hardware interfaces. We're going to talk about doing the other side of it, which is system virtual machines, where we want to imitate the physical interface, but we're going to use the same mechanisms we have to implement, you know, our operating systems, but instead of making this system call interface, we're going to make the interface look like the hardware we're working with itself. So we're imitating a hardware interface. So one thing is which one, and our choice is probably going to be what's the easiest thing to imitate. So we don't actually care that much about imitating the underlying hardware. We're going to imitate something that's simple for us to implement, but is like what real hardware would do. Okay. So I'm going to talk about how we go about doing this, but first I need to go over some terminology, because we have multiple operating systems here, and that gets confusing. So I'm going to call something a hypervisor or virtual machine monitor. And this is the thing which runs a virtual machine, a system virtual machine. This is like what VirtualBox is. And it runs a virtual machine that runs an operating system which we call the guest operating system. And the virtual machine monitor or hypervisor runs in an operating system which we'll call the host OS. Sometimes the host OS will in fact be the hypervisor itself. Sometimes the hypervisor will be a program that runs in the host OS. Okay, questions about these terms? Yeah. So like if I have a Windows machine running VirtualBox, running Linux, then Linux is the guest OS, VirtualBox is the hypervisor, and Windows is the host OS. Okay. So there's another set of choices we make when we have virtual machines, which is system virtual machines. As I said, we're imitating the hardware, but there's levels of how well we imitate hardware. So there's full virtualization. And what I mean by that is that we take a guest operating system that's meant to run on real hardware, and we run it without making any changes whatsoever. As far as the guest operating system is concerned, it might as well be running on real hardware. And there's this compromise approach called paravirtualization, where you make small modifications to the guest OS to make it support the virtual machine. And we'll see some cases where we'll want to do this, where this will just make it simpler and faster to implement our virtual machine. But the compromise is, of course, that I need to modify the guest OS, even if it's just a little bit. So these are two terms you'll see, and it's kind of a fuzzy line. So some people will say that things are still full virtualization if we have to like load a special device driver that only makes sense in a virtual machine. They might say that's still full virtualization. Some people won't say that's full virtualization. But the key idea with what people typically call paravirtualization is usually some pretty core part of the OS will need to change to support the virtual machine better and faster, like how page table entries are set. Okay. So I'm going to talk about one way of implementing virtual machines here, and maybe a second one, if probably this time or next time. There are a bunch of options here that we're not going to talk much about. Like one option is you can take the guest OS and compile it down to other machine code. That is a real thing you can do, and it sounds like it's really slow. It's not as slow as you might think. And in fact, it's basically what QEMU does. That's how QEMU is running XV6. It's basically compiling XV6 down to other XV6 machine code that can run not in kernel mode, but in user mode. Yeah.
Would this work for like proprietary like OSs? Like...
The question is, do these techniques work for proprietary OSs? All of these techniques work for any kind of OS. Like you don't need access to source code. So when I say compile the guest OS code to new machine code, I mean compile the guest OS machine code to new machine code. This is a machine code to machine code translation. And that's what QEMU does. There's nothing special about you compiling it yourself. It just sees, here is a bunch of x86 machine code, I'm going to run it. Okay. So we're going to talk about running virtual machines kind of like the way we run normal processes. But to do this, we're going to have to talk about addresses in our processes and in our hypervisor. And this is another case where we need to be careful with terminology because things get confusing. So when I talk about a virtual address in this lecture, I mean a virtual address for the guest OS. So the guest OS, my Linux in my VirtualBox is running a program. One of its addresses is what I mean by a virtual address. When I say a physical address, I mean what my guest OS thinks is a physical address. So what the Linux in my VirtualBox is setting up as the physical address in its page tables. And I'll use the word machine address to refer to the physical address as far as the hypervisor or host OS is concerned. So in the actual underlying hardware. These aren't the only terms you'll see for this. This is what I'm going to use to try to be consistent. Because if you don't have separate terms for this, it quickly gets very confusing. Okay. So we're going to talk about running the guest OS like a process. And the guest OS is just going to have a normal process control block. But we need to keep some information we aren't tracking because we're simulating the real hardware. And the real hardware has a bunch of features that our processes don't have. So one example is that you can disable interrupts on real hardware. We need to imitate that. So one of the things in our hypervisor's process control block for its guest OS is going to be, are interrupts enabled or not, as far as the guest OS is concerned. And we can set up an interrupt handler table, an exception table. One of the things that we're going to need to track is what is the one, the exception table the guest OS thinks it set up? What is the page table base register the guest OS thinks it set? We also need to figure out, does the guest OS think it's running in kernel mode or in user mode? So we need to track all this stuff which exists in the underlying hardware. We're going to have to imitate it. So this is all information that we are going to track ourselves. And we're going to act on this information when something happens in the guest OS, like a page fault. And our basic way of implementing a virtual machine is we're going to run our guest OS in user mode. And it's going to try to do some things. And they're going to trigger exceptions. So for example, it's going to try to talk to a device. And that's not going to work. We know that a normal user program, you try to do the talk to device stuff, it won't work. It's going to trigger a protection fault. You're using this IO instruction or a page fault. You're trying to access memory that you don't have access to. And we're going to react to that to do what the processor would normally do. So you try to talk to a device. You do that by trying to write to its device controller special memory. That's going to trigger a page fault. And we're going to do what the processor would do, which is actually talk to the device on your behalf. You try to disable interrupts that hopefully will be a privileged instruction and won't work. So we're going to imitate that for you. We're going to change that flag in the process control block we're tracking for you to say, you think interrupts are disabled. We'll remember that for later. And then keep running it. So we're imitating what the hardware would do, which is remember interrupts are disabled. You try to make a system call. You expect that, you know, to actually invoke your system call handler. What we're going to do on your behalf is we're going to say, you made a system call in the guest OS. That should invoke the guest OS's system call handler. We'll do that for you. Because that's what the hardware would do in this case, if it were running on a real machine. Okay, so questions about this idea? We'll go through in more detail, but from the high level view. So these are the like two big things we're going to do. So we're going to make these special instructions work using what we'll call trap and emulate. And we're also going to make exceptions and interrupt work. And we're going to basically do the same idea. In both cases, when I say trap and emulate, the basic idea is the operation triggers a trap or exception that runs some handler in the hypervisor. And the hypervisor is going to emulate what should have happened, which is either going to be doing the work of some privileged instruction or causing an exception that the guest OS thinks was triggered by the hardware, but is actually triggered by the hypervisor just jumping to the guest OS's exception handler. Okay, so let's talk about what this looks like in some more detail. So we have my VM here. So I have a guest OS program. I have my guest OS and my hypervisor. And these are conceptual layers. And when we're actually running this, we're running everything in the guest OS in user mode. And part of the hypervisor, at least conceptually, is going to run in kernel mode. Maybe a little bit runs in kernel mode and asks the user mode part what to do, but part of it's going to have to run in kernel mode. And so what we're going to have here is that, you know, this is hypervisor really runs in kernel mode. We have our guest OS, which sometimes runs in this pretend kernel mode, but we're pretending because the hypervisor is responsible for creating the illusion that that's really kernel mode. And part of the guest OS runs in its pretend user mode, which is really user mode. But we're going to create the illusion that that's the user mode that corresponds to the guest OS's kernel part. And as part of this, the hypervisor is going to track all the information about the guest OS that's in its process control block, and also the information related to implementing this pretend kernel mode that I mentioned. So let's walk through, given this, what we're going to do for, you know, this trap and emulate idea, this idea that an exception happens, we want to make pretend what happens. So we're going to start with our privilege instructions, trigger fault. So we're going to go through how that looks. So let's say my guest OS is running, it tries to access a device. That's going to trigger a protection fault. And what we want to do in our hypervisor on its behalf is actually talk to the device, then update the state of the guest OS based on the result of that. So for example, maybe it tried to read from the keyboard. So we're going to read from the keyboard on its behalf. Maybe we won't read from the keyboard in the same way. Maybe our keyboard is actually like a pipe from another process instead of the real keyboard, but we're going to do something we're going to call reading from the keyboard, and then we're going to update the guest OS's state so it looks like the thing it just read into now has the characters we read, and then we're going to start switch back and keep running the guest OS. This makes sense? So in our hypervisor, we have code that looks something like this. We have our trap. If it's a read from the keyboard, you know, we check that. One way we could check that is we could just read the instruction that triggered our trap and figure out, does this look like the keyboard reading instruction? Like, is the memory address the one for that? Or some other way of checking, we might need to like look at the registers. But we read the instruction and the current registers to figure out, is this reading from the keyboard? Is it some other type of I/O operation? And if it is, we turn that into what the hypervisor wants to do to imitate that read, which maybe is doing a read system call in the host OS, just reading from our normal standard input. And so, like in more detail, what this might look like, you know, is that we say if it's a protection fault and the guest OS is in kernel mode, if it's an in instruction, because that's what we used in XV6 for keyboard I/O, if the instruction address, which we might need to compute from a register, is the one for the keyboard data register, then we do the syscall to read the keyboard, we figure out where the instruction that the program, that the guest OS was trying to run, would have written its result into, modify that in our process control block, you know, our trap frame in this case, and also increment the PC. So we're doing the entire instructions operation sort of ourselves of this input from keyboard instruction. Okay, so questions about this? Yeah.
So wouldn't the keyboard press be initiated outside of my hypervisor that would then pass it to the guest OS? Because it seems like it's coming from within the guest OS.
So the question is, wouldn't the key press initiate the read? So yes. So we would expect there to be an interrupt from keyboard input being available. And I haven't shown how we deal with that. Well, I'll talk about that hopefully a little later. Yes, other question?
Would this be like para-virtualization?
So the question is this para-virtualization? And the answer is no. So this is our hypervisor code. So our hypervisor code is looking for the same OS code we saw before. So like this is our unmodified copy of XV6. It has this in instruction. And what we're doing is we're just saying, well, did this protection fault just get triggered by an in instruction? And if so, what type of an instruction it was. So this is just handling a trap from the existing XV6 code without any changes. So it would be para-virtualization if we said instead of that, that the hypervisor here is going to do some other instruction to make it more convenient for us. And you can see some ways in which that might be more convenient. Like here, I have to like interpret the instruction to figure out what's the destination register in order to modify it, which is means that I have like an x86 instruction decoder in my virtual machine implementation, which is a real thing they do, and like sure is not terribly convenient. Yeah, question? Okay. Okay, so another case we might have, want to look at, is let's say we have a system call. So the guest OS is running some guest OS program. It triggers a system call, and we want to make that system call turn into a system call in the guest OS. So what's going to happen is we're going to get a system call in the hypervisor. We're not going to do a normal system call. What we're going to say is, oh, the guest OS was running in kernel mode. It should actually turn into a system call in the guest OS. So we're going to look up the exception handler in the guest OS, which we know because we know when the guest OS ran the set the exception table base register instruction, we remember where it set that to. So we do that lookup ourselves, just like the processor would to handle the exception. And we're going to update the page table, so because we're running in kernel mode now, and we need to be able to access all the kernel mode memory. We'll talk about that more later. And then we return from our exception, running the guest OS in this pretend kernel mode with the system call handler that it expects to run when a program here does a system call. So one way of thinking about this is that we're kind of reflecting the system call into the guest OS, that an exception happens in the normal program, and we're doing the work of triggering the guest OS exception handler in that case, basically the same way our exception handler was triggered. We're just mirroring what the hardware did to us and doing it to the guest OS. Okay, makes sense. Okay, so later on, I have the wrong line here. Later on, after that system call handler happens, it's going to return from the exception, and that's going to be a privileged instruction. So we're going to get an exception for that, and we're going to do the same sort of emulation we talked about earlier, that our hypervisor is going to figure out, oh, that was a privileged instruction. What kind was it? Wasn't an in instruction? Oh, it was a return from exception instruction. I know how that's supposed to work. It's supposed to look up the place to go to in a particular register. I'm going to read that register, and then I'm going to do my own return from exception and arrange for that to go there by modifying the trap frame so it goes to pretend user mode, remembering it's in user mode now, and going to the user program where the system call should return. And in the middle here, we have this page table update because we're switching from user to kernel mode, so a different set of pages is accessible, so we need to make that happen. So questions about what you see here? Okay, so the basic idea for handling is that the OS still handles exceptions. You just reflect them back in, and you can look up all the information that you need because there's some previous privileged instruction which set it, and you just record it when that happens, when you imitate that privileged instruction worked normally. And so our pseudocode for that is like, for most exception types, if the guest OS is in user mode, mark it as being in your pretend kernel mode, set the stack pointer and the program counter to be where the exception handler starts. And also maybe save the old exception handler and so on. old program counter and so on. Okay. So other questions about this? So basically our like high-level idea is that we're taking this case where normally privileged instructions do a fault, you know, because we're doing something bad, and instead of like crashing the program, we're gonna say if the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode, we're gonna imitate that operation. If it thinks it's in user mode, we're gonna imitate an exception handler being run, just invoke the guest OS's exception handler. Now, one thing that I didn't deal with here is what about memory mapped I/O? So I told you doing keyboard input with this in instruction, but usually we have this memory write or read instruction if we have just everything's in physical memory. How do we do that? Well, it's going to be an access to some device address, and we can make that trigger an exception by just making sure that it's not valid in the guest OS's page table. That when we set up the page table for running the guest OS, we're not going to make the device memory valid, and it's going to trigger an exception. And we'll do the same thing I did for the in instruction. I'm going to look at the instruction that writes to that special memory, and I'm going to imitate what the device would do when you write to its memory. And this means that our hypervisor has two types of page faults. We have page faults where the guest OS is trying to access device memory, in which case you emulate it. You just say, okay, you're trying to access this like disk controller. I know how the disk controller acts when you try to write to like its status register or read from it. I'm going to imitate that for you. Or the guest OS is trying to access memory that's not in its page table. In that case, you just run the guest OS's exception handler and say, that was a real page fault. Here you go, guest OS. You know what to do about it, hopefully. Okay, so questions on? Yeah. Okay. So drop and emulate is a great way for implementing virtual machines, but it makes this assumption. And the assumption is that we can set up all the things that we want to imitate, like I/O and all these privileged instructions, to cause a fault. You know, privileged instruction not in the kernel, memory access not in the real page table. We can make that happen. And unfortunately, this is not always possible. So for example, until relatively recently, on x86, this wasn't always possible to get this to happen. There were some instructions which did different things in user and kernel mode, but didn't cause a fault. So the modern solution is you use these instruction set extensions so you don't deal with this. There are workarounds because people made VMs without this support. They're rather annoying. Okay, so let's talk about what we have so far for our VM. So for running normal user mode instructions, we just run them just like a normal process. When the guest OS tries to do I/O or other privileged operations, it triggers an exception. And we just translate that to a normal I/O. You asked about interrupts, so we can translate interrupts from real devices into interrupts in the guest OS in the same sort of way. And for exception handling, we just track whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode, and when something that would trigger an exception normally happens in the guest OS, we can make that an exception in the guest OS itself. But we have this final, very troubling piece that we're missing, which is dealing with virtual memory. And that, in fact, is one of the most complicated parts of implementing a virtual machine. The rest, The details are very tricky because we need to do things like parse instructions to figure out what they were supposed to do and deal with lots of corner cases, but it's conceptually relatively simple. Virtual memory, like, has some extra complications. So before I move on to talking about virtual memory and virtual machines, anything about sort of the non-virtual memory parts of implementing a virtual machine? Yeah?
Seems like the hypervisor is changing what the host operating system is doing in trap handling. How is that?
So the question is, the hypervisor seems like it needs to change how the host operating system deals with a trap handler. How do you do that? Yes, so the hypervisor for this type of implementation needs to have enough cooperation with the host OS in order to do that. So one example might be that you have some way of saying, I'm going to run this special process. When it has a page fault, just tell me about it.
You can.
So the get host OS needs to have some API for that, or alternately, the hypervisor needs to be the operating system itself. Yes, but yes, we need some support to set up the trap handler to do all these special things. It's not actually that exotic because if we think about debuggers get to do something special like when your program has a seg fault. And that's the kind of support we need. It's not actually that fancy. Because if you think of like all the things that trigger privileged instructions that the guest OS is doing, they're all things that in a normal program would like do something like a seg fault. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about virtual machines. So first we're gonna have virtual memory here. So we have these two page tables and we're gonna have a third. So we have our guest OS has its page table. This is what it thinks is the page table. It sets this up and it translates from virtual addresses that programs in the guest OS see to what the guest OS thinks is the physical memory, which we call physical addresses. And the hypervisor is going to have some way of mapping that to actual machine addresses. What that looks like, you know, it might be a page table, it might be some other simpler data structure. Like we might just say that we're allocating the guest OS like 100 meg of memory starting at one physical address to keep things simple. But it has some notion of where the guest OS's physical memory actually is. So the guest page table is just the page table pointer, the guest set with the privileged instruction in x86 moving to CR3. And this causes a protection fault if you try to set that in user mode. So the hypervisor knows this because it just recorded what that was when it saw a move to CR3. Just remember, that's where the page table is right now. And this, you know, could you have a page table, but it's just because we want to run multiple guest OSs at once, we need to put them at different places in memory. But when we're running the guest OS on the processor, it's going to use these virtual addresses, and they need to churn into machine addresses so the processor knows how to execute like a move. Because we don't want every move to like run some code in the hypervisor. We want it to just use the fast translation the processor does. So we need that translation to be available in a real page table so the processor knows how to execute code in the guest OS and do it fast. Because most code, we don't want to like execute things in the hypervisor. We just want it to run natively. Otherwise, our performance will be really bad. So we're going to have a page table there. I'm going to call that a shadow page table. I'm calling it a shadow page table because it's kind of like the shadow of the guest page table. It's made by using the guest page table and turning it into this other page table. So the hypervisor is going to figure out the conversion combining the guest page table translation and its translation to make the shadow page table. And it's going to provide that so the processor knows what to do when it's running the guest OS's code. So we have the shadow page table, which is the only page table the hardware knows about. And we have the guest page table, which is the only page table the guest OS knows about. And we need to have this translation happen in between. So creating this, you know, It's two sets of page table lookups. We do a lookup in the guest page table, lookup where that goes in the hypervisor page table. So what we could do is every time, you know, the page table needs to change, we just make a new shadow page table. Now, there's an issue. So one issue is, when do we do this? And most of our choices don't actually seem great. So one option would be you say, OK, every time you set the page table base pointer, we're going to create a new shadow page table. So one problem with that is creating a shadow page table is a pretty expensive operation, because we have to look up every single thing. If we want to create the whole thing, we have to look up every single thing in the page table each time. And the other issue is, what if we change the page table afterwards? We need to handle that. What if the guest OS changes its page table afterwards? We need the shadow page table to end up changing somehow. So there's a trick we can use to make this more manageable. And this is going to rely on the translation look-aside buffer. So remember, from architecture, the translation look-aside buffer is a cache for page table entries. And the processor fills this in from the page table. And it solves the same problem, that it needs to synthesize this from a normal page table. The processor does. It needs to fill in the TLB from the normal page table. And it needs to figure out when to update it. And the hypervisor is going to be able to reuse the same solution the processor uses to figure out when to update the TLB. And if you remember the paging protection assignment, you saw part of what happened there. So remember, the TLB is a cache. So when we have a page table, the processor is doing its translation with the TLB, but it has this, which is like sort of a shadow of the page table, of the real page table. And the processor, you know, asks for a particular virtual address, and it looks it up in the page table. It says, oh, it's not there. Then on demand, it brings it in to the TLB. And we can use the same technique to fill the shadow page table, that we're going to let the guest OS try to access memory that's not in the shadow page table. And when a page fault happens, we're going to say, should it have worked? If so, we'll fill in the shadow page table. Just like the processor says, should this have worked? OK, I'll fill in the TLB. I'll add an entry here so it works next time and retry. So we can imitate this to fill the shadow page table and have the hypervisor do the work instead of the CPU doing the work. It's the same sort of thing the CPU does to fill the TLB. Okay. So how about when the OS modifies a page table entry? So here we have this cache page table entry for page 4298, and the guest OS changes that. How is that, you know, how do we actually solve that in our operating system? I update the page table. How do I make sure the TLB gets updated? How does that happen? This is something which came up in the paging protection assignment. Yeah. Yes, the guest OS, the OS rather, the OS, which set this page table entry, told the processor, hey, I just updated the page table. Like, the guest OS actually told the processor that this update happened, so it didn't have to figure out, oh, you just wrote to the page table entry, it was told. And because operating systems are doing this to handle the TLB, the hypervisor can take advantage of this, because it means that the guest OS needs to tell the hypervisor that it's updating its page table, just like the real OS needs to tell the processor it's updating its page table. So we can just sneak in on those instructions that update and say, flush this part of the TLB, and use that to know when to change our shadow page table. So because the OS explicitly invalidates the TLB, we can use that signal to know the shadow page table is now out of date. So we just make sure we emulate the instruction to invalidate the TLB and make it update our shadow page table. So in this sense, our shadow page table here, is sort of imitating what the TLB is. Now, when a guest OS edits its page table, it's going to run an instruction to fix the TLB. So the hypervisor gets to look at that instruction and say, okay, I'm going to clear whatever part of the page table the guest OS had an entry edited with that instruction in my shadow, my page table that I'm giving to the processor. Okay. That questions on this? People look confused. So we can think of our shadow page table as a virtual TLB, that it caches commonly used page table entries in the guest, but in a format that the processor can use to translate to machine addresses, not to the guest's physical addresses. And it needs to be in there to run instructions, and we'll clear it when the guest OS tries to clear its TLB, and we'll fill it in as the guest OS tries to use parts of its memory, its virtual memory. Okay, questions? Yeah.
So how does this fix the issue of, so we update the shadow page table, that's a really expensive operation. So in this,
So the question is, how is this less expensive than just creating the whole shadow page table? So the idea is that we only fill in the parts that we don't rewrite the shadow page table over and over again, and we only fill in commonly used page table entries in the guest. So if the guest is not using all of its virtual memory, we don't need to populate the entire shadow page table. We don't need to spend the time doing that. Yeah.
So theoretically, we know, because of the flushing the TLB part, we know which parts of the page table the guest OS is actually using.
Question is, how do we know which parts the page table is actually using? Is it because of the flushing? So the flushing tells us which parts might have changed. We know which parts are used because if we start our shadow page table empty, they'll trigger page faults. Yeah.
So the shadow page table is used by the guest OS or the hypervisor?
The shadow page table is used by the hypervisor because it needs to provide the processor with a mapping from virtual to machine addresses to run the guest OS code. So the shadow page table said here is the page table the hardware knows about. And it's set by the hypervisor. And it's the only page table the hardware knows about.
So the hypervisor page table doesn't actually...
Yes. So this doesn't actually... Well, this might exist, but the hardware doesn't care about it. All the hardware cares about is this table. Other questions? Okay, so and part of this is also dealing with memory mapped I/O, is that we're gonna deliberately not fill in parts of the shadow page table where there's memory mapped I/O. We're just gonna leave them invalid and figure that out. Now, so this filling on demand idea means that we have some practical overhead. We don't need every time we set a page table to fill in this entire shadow page table. And we only fill in this little bits and pieces that we're using right now. And this is reasonably fast, but it's often not fast enough. So, and the main issue is that we're kind of rebuilding the part of the shadow page table we care about every time there's a context switch. Because we switched to a new program, we have a new guest page table, now we need to start filling in our shadow page table based on that. Then the guest OS switches to another program 10 milliseconds later. And we've lost all that work. And because we're losing all that work every time there's a context switch, this is often considered very slow, you know, unacceptably slow. It's reasonably fast, it's tolerable, but we really like to cache the shadow page tables in between context switches. But the problem with this is the guest won't tell you when it's writing. And the reason it won't is when that's not the active page table, the guest doesn't think it needs to tell you that the TLB needs to change because it's not in the TLB anymore. Right? So there's no reason for the guest, you know, to tell you, you know, because not always in TLB. TLB, you know, this is if written while other program is running. So if the guest switches to another program, but adds the first program's page table, it has no reason to tell us. Because that's not in the TLB anymore, other program's running, so it's not going to do that, usually. So I say usually because there's some systems where it would. So there's some TLBs where they'll support holding entries for multiple page tables at once. And this is precisely to support context switches. But unfortunately, this doesn't include x86 until very recently, so most OSs won't do this. So there's hardware support to not invalidate the entire TLB on a context switch, but most OSs, what they do is every time they switch between programs, they don't do that. They instead just invalidate the entire TLB. They don't let the processor keep anything. And that means as a hypervisor, it seems like we can't keep anything. We have to rebuild the table every time there's a context switch because the guest OS is saying, I expect you to get rid of all the TLB entries, real hardware. So as a hypervisor, we need to say, I need to get rid of all my shadow page table entries. But this is slow, so people want a better way of doing that. And so our problem here, you know, is that we have our shadow page table just for what's currently running, and when the guest OS, you know, switches from PID1 to PID2, we just need to, start rewrite that from scratch. And then when it switches back, we need to rewrite it from scratch again. So what we really want to do is, you know, we really want to have two shadow page tables, one for each process the guest OS is running. Only one of them is active because there's only one currently active page table, but we have this issue, which is that the guest can update the other page table without telling us about it. Now, if we can get the guest OS to tell us about it, this would be an example of paravirtualization, that would be great. But if we can't, we still need a solution for this if we want to run this guest OS really fast. And in fact, there is going to be one. It's just a little ugly. And what we're going to do is we're going to apply the same idea I talked about for dealing with devices. That if we want the device has this magic memory, we want to imitate that. What we do is we mark that memory as invalid in our page table. And that's going to trigger a fault when you access it. And we can imitate what would happen. We can do the same trick for the guest's page tables. We can say, well, that's part of PID2's page table. So I'm just going to mark your page table entries that point to PID2's page table as invalid. And when you try to write to them, I'm going to emulate the write. I'm going to figure out, oh, you are modifying this page table entry. So that's, I'm going to edit your page table entry, and I'm going to edit my shadow page table for that. So this means now that editing the page table entries is a lot slower. Like, it's not just a write to memory. It actually, like, runs this whole piece of complicated hypervisor code that figures out how to edit the shadow page table. But we don't modify page table entries that often. And this is going to save us in that now we can keep the entire shadow page table around even as the guest OS context switches back and forth. Okay. just by making sure that the guest OS page tables are marked read-only and we imitate the writes. And this seems really complicated, like figuring out where the whole page table is and marking every piece of it as read-only and imitating it, but this is really something that virtual machine monitors often do. Just because the performance impact is worthwhile. So questions on this idea? So basically we said, I want to know whenever you're modifying a page table, you're not telling me, I have a solution for that. I'm just going to mark your page tables as read-only and imitate it and like figure out what every write's doing. Okay. So this is like just, means that we have a shadow page table for each guest process. You don't have to do as much work. Okay, but it has some disadvantages. Like it's not obviously faster. And most notably, we have all this sort of copy on write sort of stuff we're doing, writing to the copy, which I mean. And we have to like deal with another issue, which is what happens if PID2 goes away and we deallocate its page table and use it for something else. Now we're doing all this work maintaining the shadow page table, which will never be used again. And the solution for that is you like have to figure out, oh, it's probably not really a page table anymore somehow. And if you get that wrong, things will run really slow. Okay. So questions so far? So this is maintaining shadow page tables. So we just have a second of the real page table for each of the guest OS's page table. So another thing we need to worry about is kernel mode. So our guest OS page table has kernel-only pages, and these are supposed to act differently depending on if the guest OS is in its pretend kernel mode or not. And we want the shadow page table entries to be different in each case. In the case where the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode, we want it to be able to access the pages it's marked as kernel mode only. And when it thinks it's in user mode, we want those accesses to trigger a fault so we can turn that into a page fault in the guest. So the solution for that, the simplest solution, is to maintain two shadow page tables for every process. One set up for user mode, and one set up for kernel mode. Where we just translate those kernel permission bits depending, in both possible ways and have one page table for each one. So those are the two solutions. The other solution is we could like change the kernel mode bits. Doesn't seem great. And it's a workable solution. Okay, so questions about this idea? This means in our two process idea, we have four shadow page tables now. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about VM overhead. So here, let's say I'm running in a virtual machine, and I do a read system call in a program running in that virtual machine, and the guest OS that's running in the VM switches to another program, then gets an interrupt from the keyboard, which is really that my virtual machine monitor got an interrupt and turned it into an interrupt in the VM. And then switches back to the original program returning from the read system call. So first of all, how many page table switches are there? How many guest page table switches and how many real ones? Okay, someone have an answer for the first part? Ideally, I'd like what are they? So we can easily figure out if we're adding or missing any. Anyone? At least some of them. Yeah.
I said two.
Two, okay.
Of the two switches.
Okay, original program to other, and other to original. Okay? How about shadow page table switches? I'm gonna someone else maybe? Or give me the first few at least?
You have to make at least those two again.
So you need to make, so definitely these two are at least some of them. Yeah. So we have our arig to other and other to arig. Or what's the other reason we might have to make page table switches? Of the shadow page table. Yeah.
You have to switch to the kernel shadow table?
Yes. So we have to switch so to do the user to kernel switch, we need to change page table, so now you can access the kernel's memory, the guest OS kernel's memory. So how many times does that happen? Okay, so we have one here, so this is for the syscall. Okay, that's user to kernel. And you said, where's the second one? So then we have the switch we mentioned, which is original to the other program. So we have one for the interrupt. We have a switch to kernel from user to kernel, which means that we must have had a switch from kernel to user before to start running the other program. Most likely. It's not actually given, but presumably we actually started running the other program and ran it in user mode, pretend user mode. And then we have our switch from other to arig. And then we had to return from the system call, so we had a switch from kernel to user. Yeah?
How do you know that switching to another program isn't switching to a kernel program?
We don't. So I'm saying, this is a probably. Or not user to kernel. The kernel, this is a probably here. But most likely, typical programs are going to run in user mode. So probably we have six switches of the shadow page table. So this is why virtualization can be slow, and also tells us there's something there's something here that the hardware can do to help. So I'll talk about that next time, along with some OS designs which are completely different from anything we've seen.